Hey, I'm Austin Michael Sams, and I wanted to just get some time with Dr. Robert Glover and hear about his recent experience to Rhythmia, which is a retreat center in Costa Rica where he did ayahuasca ceremonies, and just wanted to unfold the story so that other people could benefit from what he learned about himself and in his marriage. And, you know, welcome, Dr. Glover.
Austin, thanks for this opportunity. Yeah, I've been getting to talk a lot about that experience. And when you offered me the opportunity to do this little interview, I thought, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. Well, let's set the stage for people. Like, maybe we'll start with a basic question, you know, like, what is ayahuasca?
Is that basic enough?
I'm not even saying it right.
Yeah, you're saying, you know, that's why I think a lot of people say plant medicine, because ayahuasca is kind of hard to spell. You know, it's a plant medicine. It's a combination of two plants typically found in Latin America along the Amazon River, Colombia, Peru, where they mix two different plants together that together they mix in the stomach to, you know, I'm sure there's a technical term for it, but they create a psychedelic experience. And, you know, if you'd asked me about this, you know, a little over 2 years ago, I couldn't have told you anything about it.
Yeah.
But it was kind of a curious journey for me. I got introduced to the idea of plant medicine, ayahuasca, from men in the men's program that I'm in, that, you know, just different guys casually sharing their experience. And, you know, I'd never heard of it 3 years ago, maybe. And then about 2 years ago, the people at Rhythmia reached out to me and they said, we're going to do our first ever men's only retreat. And we're, you know, it's an ayahuasca retreat center, medically licensed in Costa Rica. And we do four ayahuasca ceremonies during the week long. And we want you to come down and, you know, we'll pay your expenses. I said, I've never done ayahuasca, but that sounds like an amazing idea. At the same time, I was also reading a book by Michael Pollan called How to Change Your Mind, which is all about the use of psychedelics historically, but also currently, especially in therapeutic and recreational manners in the study that's going on. And that was really an interesting book. So I highly recommend that, How to Change Your Mind. And so I got invited to come to Rhythmia. We were supposed to do it in December last year, which would have been 2020. We all know how 2020 went. So that got canceled. So, but then I just went down about 3 weeks ago now, November 2021. And it was really out of my comfort zone. I've never done, you know, I didn't smoke pot till I was like 35 and probably never got high till I was in my 40s. And so that's really the strongest drug I've ever used is marijuana and alcohol. We'll put that in the category. So I'd never used, you know, cocaine, ecstasy. I'd never used anything else. And I grew up during, I'm in the baby boom generation, but I grew up during the war on drugs where the U.S. government had started attacking, you know, when Nixon couldn't get people to go to Vietnam because they're all dropping acid, you know, they prior to that, government actually researched LSD. And then so because nobody wanted to go to fight a war when, you know, they were all, you know, loving each other, you know. And so that started. And then also the war on drugs where, hey, let's put a lot of black men in prison by, you know, making cocaine, you know, and things like that. So I grew up during that with all the government propaganda. You know, this is your brain on drugs. You're going to jump off buildings if you take LSD. And so to go do ayahuasca and get out of my comfort zone, and I'm a little bit of a control freak. I don't like feeling out of control. So to go do that, it was a push for me. And so since I knew it was a push, I knew I needed to go do it.
Yeah. I've heard someone say, yeah, what we resist most is what we most need to do.
So, yeah. Well, what we resist persists. Yeah.
Yeah. So, that's right. And I know you're a licensed, you know, marriage and family therapist. So you're well versed in talk therapy as a modality. So, but you're telling me you haven't done like plant-based therapy. It's really a therapeutic approach. Sounds like Rhythmia takes a very intentional approach. You're not just going on a drug trip in the jungles of Costa Rica, right? Like give me a sense of like what the place is like, right? Some people haven't been there. What's it like?
Well, and you're so really there's two different questions in that, you know, in terms of using it for therapeutic reasons, using plant medicine or any psychedelic for that matter.
Right.
And so let me just address that first. Then I'll talk a little bit about Rhythmia, because one of the things I like about that book, How to Change Your Mind. And if you follow Tim Ferriss or Sam Harris, all of these guys are really strongly into advocating for the use of psychedelics, mind altering substances, and supporting research on them. And one of the really cool things is that, you know, universities and governments are even financing research, especially looking at the use of MDMA, ketamine, psilocybin, not so much ayahuasca, as far as I can tell in the US, but maybe more in Europe, and combining them with therapy, with training therapists to use these substances, often microdosing, to help facilitate the therapeutic process. Especially where they've really focused on is in dealing with trauma, whether it be childhood trauma, PTSD, and assisting people near death, you know, with terminal cancer, things like that, of using a combination of therapy and substances to help the process and really reporting fantastic results. Now, the further extension of that is, okay, what if we're not using this to, you know, to deal with trauma or deal with, you know, the death experience? What if we're just using it to open, to be more open, to be more conscious, to be more present, to kind of, you know, from a Buddhist model, break out of the duality that, you know, there's self and other. And because one really cool thing about psychedelics is they do tend to break that wall down, where there is no self and other, they're just one. And we are a part of that one. So there's really exciting stuff going on that, you know, I've been saying as a therapist, I'm no longer a licensed therapist because I don't live in the States and I don't practice anywhere where I need a license. But I think we may look back at some point of saying, remember the dark ages of therapy where we just sat on, you know, a therapist's couch for an hour, you know, once a week for a few years and thought that would make us better. Because I promise you, and we'll come back to this, the experience I had on those four ayahuasca journeys, and my wife got to come with me, and she got to do the ceremonies as well. She was apart from the group of men because it was an all men's retreat, but it cracked us both open in our own unique ways. And she is somebody who has a lifetime of trauma. And I've just seen, wow, just things dissolve in her as I've watched them dissolve in me as well, but almost more powerfully in her because she brought so much more of a lifetime of trauma. So, okay, to talk about Rhythmia itself. Yeah. I'd heard warnings from people that, you know, that not every shaman out there, you know, is trustable, and not every ceremony is well monitored, you know, in terms of the practice of using psychedelics. They talk about set and setting, you know, how is it set up for you to have the most positive experience or the most beneficial experience? And Rhythmia does that beautifully. The owner of it, who started it, I think 2016, bought this resort. It's a beautiful resort, kind of, it's just spread out and comfortable. Food is amazing. There's classes every day. I mean, you actually have a little thing on your wrist that you beep in and beep out because they track data. They want to know who went to what classes and who got the best results from it. So they're constantly looking at how to provide the ultimate experience for people. And I love that research-based, data-based view of it. And so it's a beautiful resort. You go to some classes in the morning, the evening. They have some other extra things that come along with it that are just part of the experience of being there. You do breath work, but the four ceremonies, they begin Monday night. You get there Sunday, Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night goes all night long. Most of them, you get started probably about 7-ish and go to about 2 or 3 in the morning. The other started about 9 and went to about 9 in the morning. And every ceremony is different. Each one has a different shaman leading it, different music, different feel to it. And I think even a different mixture of the ayahuasca, the plant medicine. And one of the beautiful things about it is, you know, they have the shamans leading it, but they have many trained assistants that are there and both walking around and, you know, just making sure everything, you know, some people puke a lot. They give you a bucket and roll of toilet paper. I went to the bathroom a lot, but you know, I never did puke. But so they're cleaning that up, but they're also checking in on people. They have medics, they have EMTs there 24/7. Wow. One of the owners is a medical doctor, and he's there. So it's really well monitored, and it felt very contained. And they do create a really clear container. You know, once you're there, don't leave. You can go outside to this areas of the grounds. They have people, you know, just making sure everybody's okay. And again, every ceremony is different. They usually began with the shaman. Everybody comes up and the shaman talks for a little while about just what to expect and the experience of it, about life. Then you drink a little cup and go back to a mattress and lay down. And then at some point, things change. And I was like, man, isn't it amazing how the music is perfectly timed to come on right when I started, you know, having a vision or started experiencing something different. So it's beautifully orchestrated to create the most positive experience. And some of the things that I was taught are really basic, and I've been doing them ever since. And actually, they're things I taught before, but they really got cemented. They say, well, while doing the ceremony, and they say, you know, the medicine stays with you even after the ceremony. They say, breathe. I mean, that's just so, that just they repeat that over and breathe. We forget to breathe, you know, like, breathe, open. So open and relax to it. And the other one is go towards what's difficult. Go towards what's hard. Go towards what scares you. So they say, if you see a vision of puppies and a vision of your childhood abuser, you know, go towards the thing that scares you, that's the hardest. And what another little mantra they have is what's coming is going. So whatever comes up for you, they say, is on its way out. Because ayahuasca, the way they set up the ceremony and the kind of I don't know what the best word for it is, just how they talk about it, is that it is cleaning things out, is purging. That's why you either tend to throw up, need to go to the bathroom a lot, even yawn real intense. First night I was just yawning, and people said, but you yawn really loud. I was better than puking really loud. And so it is bringing things up and letting them go, letting you look at them, you know, and feel them and experience, and then letting them go. Just as an example, after the second night, when I saw my wife, when all was said and done, and then second night really cracked me open, and it did my wife as well. And she came up to me, and first thing she said is, I saw every one of my abusers and I forgave every one of them. And she said that stuff. And I go, wow, that, you know, could you do that in an hour or two of therapy? She's had therapy.
Yeah.
And has worked on those issues, but never walked up to me and said, oh, I've forgiven, really forgiven. Not just, you know, it was an emotional release. So the stuff that comes up goes. And she later told me that earlier that night, when the ceremony first began and the medicine kicked in, she said she was lying over there. And my wife is Mexican, so this is all in Spanish, she's telling me. She says, I was lying there thinking, who is that fucking asshole that brought me here and, you know, made me come do this? And she said she got up and left the building and wanted to leave. And she said, wow. The people were there. They kind of talked with her. And I mean, they took really good care of her. Mainly because she didn't speak English, but there's of course a lot of Spanish speaking people there in Costa Rica at the place.
Yeah.
And you know, they helped her, you know, just move through it. And she kind of went back and then just had this amazing experience. So she wanted to run from what was painful and uncomfortable. I never experienced anything that I wanted to run from. Everything I experienced was either just like amazingly beautiful and insightful, or just like emotionally moving in a very powerful way. Nothing overwhelmed me. There was nothing, oh, I don't want to do this, don't want to do it. So but everybody has a completely different experience. There were guys there that, you know, wasn't till the last night that they actually, you know, had a breakthrough. I mean, like every first three nights were like painful, dark.
Okay.
And you know, I heard lots of guys' stories about going through some really dark stuff. But again, you breathe, you open, and you go towards, you know, what you don't want to go towards, because that's how you go through it. So it really, you can see there's a therapeutic process to the medicine. And as they often say, you know, the shamans say that the medicine is wise. They call it mama or grandma, grandmother, and it's wise. There's a wisdom in it. And, you know, I'm not real metaphysical. I'm not real woo-woo. I'm more analytical. But, you know, you come away believing there's a wisdom in the medicine. Every single night was a different experience for me. No night was the same. And everybody I talked to had completely different experiences than me. Other than by the time the week's over, everybody is smiling and light and engaged and hugging. And like, so I think you can say the common experience there is that probably, you know, the majority of the people, and, you know, again, they track people's experience of it. And they say like, something like 96% of the people that do the Rhythmia program report having experienced a personal miracle, some breakthrough, something amazing that shifted inside of them. And I believe it, you know, because both my experience, my wife's experience, and the experience she and I've had together since then, it's been amazing. You know, she and I've been married 5 years. We've had some struggles, usually the same struggle over and over again. I've been in a men's program with a coach to work on it. She's gone to therapy. There's such deep love between us. We've been committed to work through the things we struggled with, and the experience we had together just cracked us open and gave us that shift that we'd been moving in positive directions, but never had the deep emotional shift that where now it feels different between us. And so, amazing. I'll keep it. Wow. It was amazing. It was this. And again, this isn't hyper, you know, trying to sell anybody. It's just like, it was as powerful of an experience that I've had. My wife and I both, you know, are eager to go do more ceremonies. My wife grew up in poverty in Guadalajara, Roman Catholic, very restrictive, very superstitious. And so for her to go do this, that was a big leap. I was just out of my comfort zone. She was way out of anything culturally. And now, like, she's the one that's gotten back looking for here where we live in Puerto Vallarta. She's actually found shamans that do ayahuasca ceremonies here. So she was the one that didn't know what she was getting into. And now, like, you know, is just cracked open and wanting to do more and telling everybody about it. So it's that kind of experience.
Yeah. What I love about what you shared, and I've been hearing more as well, you said there's some people who are influencing the kind of public discourse about plant-based medicine as a therapy. And I think we need to close the loop. What's helpful for me to understand is that, like, through talk therapy modalities or reading books, you're accessing, you know, your thinking mind, your prefrontal cortex. And from what I understand with psychedelics, it's not that your brain is turned off, but it allows you the capacity to access a different part of your brain that you might not be in touch with. And so, yeah, I'm also very skeptical of the woo-woo, but from a very scientific standpoint, you're putting your brain in a different state than you probably have been in your whole life. So it's no surprise that you're experiencing different, I don't know if they're visions or feelings. And so you're just not only purging physically, it sounds like you're purging emotionally and maybe spiritually too.
Yeah. And you know, again, I can't explain the experience. Well, what I can't explain what happened, because every night was completely different. And you could kind of to address what you're saying, that's what a lot of research is finding now, is what do psychedelics do to the brains? They can hook people up, you know, with the brain monitors. And one of the things, and I got this out of Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind book, there's actually some pictures in the book of this. There's a part of the brain called the default mode network, and it's kind of right in the center of the brain. And when we're not involved in tasks, like I got to get this done, got to get this done, when we're just like daydreaming, driving our car, still, that's where we tend to go. That's why it's called default mode. We go, and the default mode is really all about I. It's me and my world. You know, we'll just kind of go into that space of thinking about this thing and how it relates to us, our worries, our anxieties, or even our daydreams. And what they found, and I think it was experimenting with psilocybin mushrooms, that what the researchers were surprised to find that the default mode network on the psilocybin went dark, meaning that there's not blood or oxygen going to that part of the brain, and other parts of the brain that never talk to each other are lit up and creating neural connections. Right. And you know, they're still, I think, studying and, you know, developing theories to what's happening with that. And, you know, is it unlocking a collective unconsciousness, you know, an experience wired into our DNA? Is it just brain having hallucinations? You know, they're really still just, I think that the research ahead is going to be fascinating. But for example, going back to the wisdom of the medicine, first night there, we all drank and went back to our beds and it was just quiet. I thought, well, you know, I can get this kind of experience just kind of meditating. It was just calm, but no real big experience. So then they called to come up and do a second cup, probably 2 hours later. Then things got going. You started hearing people puking. People got restless. The guy next to me spent most of the night puking or lying on his bed, kicking his feet back and forth like a little child, you know, just, you know, like that. And one of the things I say to is, whatever's happening around you is part of your journey. So the guy next to me is kicking his feet. And I'm going, you know, fucking asshole, you know, I'm projecting all this stuff. I found out the first night, already knew this, but the question you asked first night is, show me what I've become. Well, I'm a cynic. I'm really cynical. And I was cynical about this guy. And I just watched myself. I watched my cynic. And it was really, really just, and accepted that it was part of my survival as a child, but I'd always just hid it and kept it away. Now I could just open it up and say, all right, I'm cynical. It's a survival mechanism. So I noticed myself being cynical of the guy next to me and having great empathy at the same time for what he was going through and recognizing it's part of my journey. And I realized, oh, this is my little brother here kicking my bed, just like my little brother used to do. And you know, I told my wife afterwards, I said, my biggest insight was about my cynic and that my brother, you know, it's like his mission in life was to fuck with my peace, to just fuck with my, you know, calm. And I came to realize my brother was a teacher, that he was an important part of my life. So the experience I had that first night with the guy next to me, and then I got to be really good friends with him over the next week. And someone told me later, he'd even said during that experience how Zen-like I was and just how it calmed him that I was so Zen-like. And I said, yeah, he didn't really realize. I said, that fucking asshole, you know, he keeps kicking my bed. But it was like, that was my first night. It was just an acceptance of things. Second night was maybe the purest psychedelic night. It was like, where'd they hide all the lasers in the ceiling? Because it was a fucking light show, dance party. I mean, my brain was open to, like, you know, the oneness of all that it is. You know, there's this light, surgery, octopuses, space invaders. You know, I had visions of our extraterrestrial ancestors bringing us to Earth. I saw my own conception. I saw, you know, the conception of the cosmos. Wow. And I laughed. And there was times I was crying so hard, I felt tears running out of my ears. But there were tears of joy. It was just laughing at the cosmic joke of it all, that none of it really matters. And that night, my intention was to say, ask me, you know, show me who I can be and what I can do. And like, it just came to me, just, I'm here to shine. I'm here for my light to shine. Kind of the little gospel song I sang when I was a kid, you know, there's a light of mine, I'm going to let it shine, hide it under a bushel. And it's like, I'm just here to be as big as I am and radiate everything about me without shame or hiding it or fear. And so that night was just, like I said, I came out of that experience, both being in it and the watcher of it. Like I said, it really was like a light show. That night they played, you know, it felt like dance music all night. It felt like, you know, dancing around the fire, devil worship, giving my soul. I was just watching all of this and enjoying it. And as I said, I came away that, okay, either this is just one big cosmic joke or one big cosmic dance party. That's all that this is about. And, you know, here we are taking everything so serious. You know, what if this happens? Oh, I got to pay this or what? It was a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful night. And like I said, it cracked my wife open. And I even looked over after, you know, they turned the lights on and I looked over, and I could see my wife over there, and she was dancing with a woman, dancing with one of the shaman's assistants, she was in white. The other one, I thought, I've never seen my wife dance with a woman. How beautiful is that? And it's just like, everything was beautiful. Everything was beautiful. Okay.
That was the second night.
Second night. Third night was a much more different ceremony. It was led by a woman shaman. It had a much more feminine feel. And her husband actually led the previous night. And I would say, even though it had a feminine feel, she's probably more masculine than her husband. Most of the music was acoustic, not piped in over the speakers, just a different feel. And in that one is a very sobering experience where it's just, I just felt the weight of humanity destroying this planet, and kind of had the vision that we've destroyed multiple other planets, you know, in our history, and that we can't, you know, it's like in the vision, there are enough planets in the cosmos that we can go to and repopulate. But it's like I got this mission that I have to stop the destruction of technology. Not that technology is bad, but we got to do it better. We got to do it cleaner. We got to quit burning up planets, because we need to be able to breathe. And it's kind of like in that vision, we've had to go to many different planets just to breathe, because we burned up the ones we've been on. The fuck, we're burning this planet up. And it's like, in that one, I had the vision that I was called to come be the king and lead for 10,000 years. And I accepted that challenge to lead in a way, tears, not as this ego thing. Hey, look, I'm the king for 10,000 years. I get this, yeah. All, you know, again, really metaphysical, but I felt a deep, charge to step up and lead in a way that will last for 10,000 years in ways to help preserve our planet and preserve the people on the planet. And it was an extremely sobering night. I woke up with a deep sense of mission. And so again, very different than the other nights. And then the last night.
Can I just say something real quick?
I want to
jump in, because I'll give you a chance to take a drink of water. What I could see being really healing for people in that is, whatever the visions that come up, people come, and I want to ask you in a minute, once you go through each night, like what was, you know, maybe the specific overarching thing you wanted to work on, not like the nightly things as intentions. But what was so great about what you just shared is the shame reduction. If I'm being given that charge, I must be worthy of something like that. And so if you're entering into an experience with any amount of shame, whatever the vision that comes up, for you, like I could just see how powerful that would be. You know, the specifics, who knows what that manifestation will actually be, but like if you can carry that worthiness of being a king for 10,000 years, fuck, you could like change some shit right here, right now, if you embody that energy and shed that shame that like you're not worthy of such a calling, you know?
And that's beautiful, because you actually just opened up one more aha for me that I'd not really had till you talked about it. Because when I talk about fourth night, it was all about shame. That was my intention.
Okay. But
the third night, how I was born with a cleft lip. So, you know, just, you know, my lip, my palate was intact, but I had a surgery at 5 days old, another one 5 years old, and had another one when I was in my early 40s, just to kind of line up my nose and lip. My son also was born with a cleft lip. And in the vision, and of course I had some degree of shame about that growing up. I'm defective. You hear hair lip jokes, but I've never felt really different, but I always have felt, well, if I didn't have that, I'd be more attractive. You know, I'd be more valuable, blah, 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 blah. So I had some shame around having a cleft lip, but in the vision, that when the powers that be came and said, you've been called to lead, you've been called to be king, because you have the mark of the king, which is that's the mark of the king, and your son will someday succeed you because he has the mark of the king. Now it just so happens, and I thought, right here I have a tattoo on my arm that's a crown. Everybody, you can see it upside down, but it's a crown. And it says El Rey, and El Rey is the king in Spanish. And my wife and I, before we got married, one day she said, come on, we're going into town. We have an appointment. I said, what kind of appointment? She said, to get tattoos. And so I have a crown that says El Rey. And on her left hand, because she's left-handed, she has a different kind of crown. It says La Reina, which is the queen. And so we've had those. So in the vision, I have the tattoo that says, look, the tattoo says the king. But yeah. I had the mark that says that's the king. Until you said that about releasing shame, I'd never thought about that mark. Of releasing the shame of somehow being defective, and rather seeing it as the mark of the king, that the people know this person is called to be king.
That's beautiful. Wow. Yeah. Like we, in our culture, right, we shame different aspects, especially visually. So to reframe that,
yeah,
is powerful. So what happened on the fourth night?
Fourth night. Radically different than the others. Like it was all night. The shaman is from Colombia, and I love this guy. Mitra is his name. And, you know, they do a little talk beforehand, and he's funny. And you know, and he's, you know, it's in English, but you know, Spanish is his primary language. So every now and then he'd ask somebody, how do you say this word? And he was really funny, real dry wit. And so he talked, and then we did this. And so we created intention. And so I went up to drink the cup. My intention was to release all shame, fear, and anxiety, and especially sexual shame and sexual fear. Because
yeah,
you know, I grew up in a fundamental Christian church. I grew up in America. You know, I just grew up with you know, permeated with sexual shame. You know, we're bombarded with sexual stimuli and then told we're bad for, you know, for being sexual people. So that was my my commitment. So went and laid down and, you know, didn't really have, you know, a lot of experience. But then I fell into a deep sleep, didn't realize I was in a deep sleep. And then they have a state that's called nada, which in Spanish means nothing, but it's not nothing. It's a very deep nothingness where really no visions, nothing, just, and it's, they say still, the medicine is still working on the brain. Well, I woke up from that deep sleep and the back of my shorts were wet. And I started feeling, well, the front's not wet. My body's not sweating. So I'm not sweating through my clothes. I thought, oh fuck, did I shit in my shorts? And so I went to the bathroom and I mean, because I'd already been shitting a lot anyway, there wasn't a lot to come out and it was just wet really. And I thought, oh, okay, I guess this is how you start releasing shame. And then a lot of my visions that I did have that night then were about my earliest moments in life of around shame of, I think my grandmother was my primary caregiver because my mother went back to work. And I think I was just shamed for, you know, messing in my diaper and left in it. And shamed in the looks that I got. Because my wife can get a look about her. And this is kind of one of these triggers. She'll get a look about her that I just interpret as disgust, that I'm disgusting and I'm going to be left and I'm going to die. It's a deep emotion. And I've been working on this for a while. And so in that, I realized, I think it is related to shitting myself. And, you know, I asked my intention, I want to release shame. So that night before I went, the only night that I put an extra pair of shorts in my bag was that night. How I had a knowing, because, you know, I was going through my drawer getting ready. And like a voice said, wonder, like an audible voice, but something said, pack another pair of shorts. And I thought, I won't need them, and went to put them back. And I thought, I'll pack them. I wish it said pack two pair of shorts. So I changed and wandered around outside a little bit, went back for second medicine. And the shaman said, did you have any visions? I said, no. He said, okay. And then kind of gave me, so I went back and went into another deep sleep. So when I woke up from that one, it was light out. So it was about 6 a.m, I think. And my shorts were wet again. And I thought, fuck. And went to the bathroom and, you know, had shit my shorts again. So I didn't have another pair. So I just had to, you know, clean up best I could and put a bunch of paper towel inside. And I wandered outside and ran into my wife and we sat and talked for a few minutes. I told her, you know, I shit my shorts. And I said, but, you know, it's okay. I said, I asked to let go of shame. So what better way to start letting go of shame than, you know, shitting your shorts in public? And so then went up for the third cup. It's already light. And it was only night that I did three cups. And the shaman asked me again. I said, did you have any visions? And I said, no, but I shit my shorts twice. He put his arms around me. He said, that's amazing. You're free. There's wildness in that. You're free now. You know, be wild. You know, you can shit your shorts. And he like was like kind of like excited and dancing. And I thought, that's just what I needed. And so... Yeah. You know, looking back, it's like every time I got just what I needed. And, you know, if you're going to set yourself up and say, I want to let go of all shame and fear and anxiety, well, be ready to, you know, go into the thing that brings up what is the most profound shame that we humans have. It probably is around our bodily excrements and sex. And those parts of our bodies are camping out right next to each other. And I thought, it was what I needed. So every experience was completely and totally different, and every one amazingly profound and spot on, which, again, you know, without getting too woo-woo about it, you know, how does that happen? I don't know. But does it happen? Yeah, everybody you talk to has, you know, some, every time, some profound experience with it, and it's different than yours.
You mentioned that this experience, so you went through all four ceremonies with us, but you mentioned that it cracked you and your wife wide open. You shared some of your personal experience. How did that involve your wife? Like, what has it done to your relationship? Yeah. Let's get personal here.
Yeah.
And you know, sexual shame, you know, like,
yeah, you've heard me talk a little bit about it. So yeah, because I've been talking about this piece. As I said, I got into a men's program about a year into my marriage because we were struggling, and I love this woman and I wanted to work through. I was struggling because my wife, being the kind of the typical jealous Latina, oh, you're looking at that woman's butt, or you're smiling while you're on your phone, you must be talking to a woman, you know, and just accusations. And I've got my core stuff around my own shame is that, no, I'm a good guy. I'm good. I don't do bad things, even though I've done a lot of bad things.
Some might call you a nice guy.
Oh, no. You know, of course.
Anyway, no more.
Probably knows I've written a book about that. But that's the thing. The becoming a nice guy is shame driven. I'm bad, so I've got to become good. I got to hide things about me that are bad. So I was having these reactions to my wife. So she was having her intense reactions of always thinking I was about to abandon her. I was going to cheat on her. Mm. That's her life story. I asked her, I said, have you ever known a man in your life who was faithful? She said, no, I don't trust. Yeah. And so, and not that she doesn't trust men. She doesn't trust women. She Anybody. Just thinks, women in Mexican culture, you know, the women sport here is trying to get the attention of men who are in relationship. Trying to, you know, women will do that. It's part of culture. So that's her experience. So we were locked in this stuff, and we've done a lot of work. I've done a lot of work, a lot of reframing, a lot of soothing. She's gone to therapy, but yet this stuff would still come up. And her reactions are less intense than they would last. They'd get done quicker. I wouldn't go so much into defending myself or even blowing up. Or I've blown up a few times. I've thrown a few things. I've said some hurtful things that I feel bad about. And so things were getting better. Well, so after the third night, when the ceremony ended, the guy sitting next to me hadn't talked to me all night long. And all of a sudden he just opens up and he said, I was here last week. My wife on Wednesday night told me about an affair she'd had 10 years ago. On Friday night, she told me she wanted a divorce. She even went out and got a tattoo of that date as the beginning of her new life. The medicine told her to get divorced. And he said, I stayed another week just to be here. So the guy's just telling me all this stuff. Man, he was hurting. And like my wife, you know, it's time to leave. You know, lights are on. My wife, he said, oh, your wife's waiting. I'll let you go. And I said, well, let's talk more, you know, while we're here this week. And so while we're walking back to our room, and it's dark and all, I was telling my wife what he told me. And so we got back to our room, and you know, it was about 3 a.m. and my wife goes in and takes off her clothes, taking her makeup off, comes out of the bathroom and says, I have to tell you something. And sits down on the bed and says, this is really hard. And she told me about something she had done after we were married that she felt a lot of shame about, and that she'd never told me about it. I said, that I'm going to have to process this. But I said, thank you for telling me. I respect your courage. And she said, and there's this other thing too, that, you know, that she hadn't told me the truth about early in our dating experience, about a relationship she had with another guy. And she said, I told you this, but the truth was this. I said, okay, you know, I'm glad you're telling me. And then we get in bed and I said, anything else? And most of it was like her life long before she's with me, of just, you know, her experience of growing up as a poor woman in Mexican culture. And And really when all this, and so she just starts opening up. And so for the next several days, she just keeps opening up and telling me more things. Either she had told me or told me the opposite of what was true, or maybe even had told a lie about. But as I said, 95% of it was stuff before she was with me. So it wasn't like, you know, deceit of when she and I were together. And I've always seen her as like the most honest person I know. And, and so to see, number one, that she withheld some things or had told me the truth, you know, there was a little hurt there, but more than anything, it felt liberating, like, you know, and she kept becoming freer. And I found that I was actually really drawn and intrigued to the things she talked about. And I felt closer. And I kept saying, you know, the next few days, and even coming back, you know, we'd wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and just talk and then make love. And it's like the closeness, and that's continued, you know, it's been 3 weeks or so since we got back, the depth of sharing. And she goes, oh, here's another thing I haven't told you about, you know, something like when she was 12 or 18 or 25. And, and really a very core piece of what's come up is that probably due to early abuse, but probably just due to how she is. She says, you know, I like sex. I love sex. I love pleasure. And said, I always have, but I always felt shame about it. And she said, my dad was the same way. She said, she used the word in Spanish, caliente, is horny. She said, my dad loved sex. It was always, you know, he basically cheated on her mother, you know, multiple times. And so there's always the family shame around that. He was bad. But she said, I've always loved sex. She said, since I was like 12, I've liked how it felt in my body. And I said, let's keep working together, both of us, to clear out all of our sexual shame, all of our fear. And I said, whatever that takes, whatever it works. And so we've had this mantra since then. We say to each other, you belong to me and you're free. And so we're claiming each other. We're claiming each other in love, that I'm here for you. I'm not leaving you. There's nothing you can say or do that'll make me love you less. And that was her fear. If she told me these things from her life, or told me some things she'd kept hidden from me, that I'd leave her. Of course, that's everybody's biggest fear, right? And by opening up, there's no way I could leave this woman. I'm so much more in love with her. And so for both of us now, we're exploring, what does it mean to be free? I still consider us to have a container of a monogamous relationship. And we're free in terms of however we live our life. There's no secrets between us, that anything that feels like I'm called for this, well, you just tell the other person first. And she's always said to me, you know, if you ever want to have sex with another woman, will you just tell me first? And I've always had that commitment with her. And I've never had the desire to be with another woman since I've been with her. But I said, I will tell you. And so that's kind of our operating procedure now. We just tell each other everything. Everything's okay. Every thought is okay. Every impulse is okay. Every want is okay. And even every action is okay if it's not abusing or hurting anybody else, and it's mutually satisfying to both of us. And so her freedom is taking her down her own path of basically how to experience pleasure with no shame or guilt. And I will give you a quick example of that. Somebody that you know, because he's in our men's program, Gregory is down here for vacation. And he invited Lupita and I and our kids to come out to his house 2 nights ago and meet Lee, his girlfriend, and his kids. And we had just a beautiful dinner and a great time. And his girlfriend is so engaging and so friendly and would do her best to speak Spanish with Lupita. And so after dinner, we've been drinking my margaritas. I brought margaritas, and you know, they brought out some other tequilas. So we all had a nice buzz on. And Lupita was sitting next to Lee, Gregory's wife, and I'm sitting next to Gregory, and the kids have all gone their own way. It's getting late. And we're, you know, kind of giving my friend Gregory a hard time. He needs to open his heart to this amazing woman. And I didn't see the sequence, but his girlfriend like crawled up in Lupita's lap and was sitting on her lap. And Lupita was kind of, you know, tucking in her sides of her dress a little bit, saying, you need to dress a little more sexy for Gregory, you know, and Gregory, you need to open your heart. But then Lupita said, I felt shame that she was sitting on my lap because I was afraid the kids were going to see me and think her kids. And they're 16 and 14. I was afraid my kids were going to think bad thoughts of me or think I was a lesbian or I was doing something wrong. And so this is an example how to just have the experience. It was this very spontaneous experience of two women that connected well. And Gregory and I have had a connection for 4 years, so I love him deeply. Everything was in the open. Everything, you know, there was nothing, you know, nobody took clothes off, but she felt shame for that experience. And so we've talked about that, of how to open, how to clear that out, how to let go of this thing that, oh, I have to, if anybody thinks bad of me or thinks I'm a lesbian or thinks I'm this or I'm sinful or, and so that's her path. My path has been, my freedom more has been, it's around my time. You know, I need time to be with men. I need time to be still in nature. I need time to go away. And like, you know, Lupita and I were talking about, I want to go do a tour in Europe this summer, of spending 3 weeks Northern Europe doing workshops. And when I told her that, even before I went to Rhythmia, she says, yeah, you should do that. And then, you know, I said, plan is you can come meet me in the UK and we'll spend time together. So mine is, I give away my freedom around my passion, my work, my time. And so we're both supporting each other in that you belong to me. There's the claim. I'm always going to be here for you. And you're always going to be here. We're together. And we're supporting each other to explore freedom and releasing that shame, fear, whatever comes up that blocks us and inhibits us. So it's been beautiful. And, you know, we're both learning so much about ourselves. You know, when she tells me about how she got sexual pleasure from this past experience, but she had shame about it, I'm just like fucking aroused going, this turns me on. I, you know, not only do I not judge you, tell me more stories. I'm loving it. So, you know, I'm getting to watch my own sexual wiring that I've also had so many blocks around growing up, funding Christianity, like I've talked about. And you relate to that. I know you do. Mm-hmm. So that is how it's cracked us open, that we've been so intimate, so revealed, so revealing. She's told me things she's never told anybody. I've told her things about my past that, you know, and it's just like, oh, okay. You know, I'm glad you told me that. I know you better now. So that's been for us just a profound experience since we, you know, did the Rhythmia thing.
Yeah. I want to share a reflection. Two words are coming up: openness and acceptance. Uh-huh. That's what I hear in this story, is the common thread. So whether you do an experience like this as a couple or individually, it sounds like what, you know, ceremony plant medicine experience is, it just opens you up to what's under the surface already, right? So, yeah. And if you go as a couple, I started to worry that we were going in a direction that, if, you know, people were like, I'm not going with my partner, that's scary, but it's there already. It's inside, it's under the surface. There. And so this opens up, but it's beautiful just to hear your arc in your relationship of the acceptance piece. And I'm glad you explained you belong to me and you're free, because I didn't understand the first part until you explained it. You belong to me. It's a claiming, but it's not an ownership mentality. I know you don't like the ownership.
Exactly.
It's not fusion. It's not enmeshment. It's not that you can't be free, right? That's the second part. But really what I heard is, I accept you. I accept you. And so whether you go with a partner, go through this experience or another experience, it's just as beautiful to see two human beings or an individual like yourself being willing to be vulnerable and open and just accepting yourself. That's what's coming up for me. Am I hearing you right?
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. Because you mentioned earlier, what was my overarching intention of going to do the ayahuasca? And really I went with is just surrender. That was it.
Surrender,
open, and accept. Because that's really where I've been in my life in a lot of areas, you know, for the last few years, consciously surrendering, opening, and accepting. And I went there with that intention. And you know, it's happening. You know, the surrender, the acceptance, the opening. And, you know, when we human beings can do that, we really can let our light shine. We really can accept ourselves completely for who we are. We really can reveal ourselves to other people. We can really love and be loved.
And yes.
And that really is the you belong to me and you're free, as you said.
Yeah.
You know, most of us, you belong to me, so therefore you can't. You know, yeah. Ours is you belong to me and you can't. And yeah. Really the underlying connection is we will just share everything with each other. Nothing will be
hidden. Yeah.
And it's when we hide stuff, we hide it because we have shame, we have fear. Yeah. And the hiding of it perpetuates the shame and the fear. So we've created a container. And, you know, some of the greatest teachers, the people I love, whether it's David Snarch, who wrote Passionate Marriage, and he talks about the sexual crucible where we do our deep work. David Data talks about finding God through sex. And so, you know, Osho writes about Tantra, of using sex. So this is not a new model, that through sex that we can open to our deepest selves and open fully to other people. But, you know, we live in, so again, our cultures, even just the word sex has a negative connotation to it. And if you want sex, you're bad. No, we're sexual creatures. You know, that's the depth of who we are. So I'm really seeing the profound power of using that sexual crucible, that sexual core part of all of us, to do our deep healing. And then like I said, combined, you know, when the plant medicine just opened that up for us so fully, that, you know, for now, I've always said that intimacy is knowing self and being known by another. And that's what's been happening with Lupita and I. It's just a deeper knowing of self and a deeper knowing of the other, and the releasing of the shame and the fear through that sexual crucible, that sexual container. And it's been profound. About the only word.
Yeah.
There's lots of words. Like, people have asked me, well, can you use words to explain the experience? I said, nah. I said, that's always been the struggle. Philosophers, you know, to explain nirvana, to explain heaven, to explain God, to explain love, there's no words that do it. And like an example, you know, if you've ever, you know, hit a baseball, hit a fastball right on the sweet spot of the bat and heard the crack and felt it and knew that that ball was gone, you know, you can't explain that feeling. You know, hitting the three wood and just, you know, driving that ball off the tee perfectly. You're a surfer, you know, to just get on that
wave.
You feel it, you catch it, you know it, you're in the flow of it. You and the wave are one. What are the words for that, man? You could try to tell me, but I've only, you know, sucked up a lot of ocean water when I've tried surfing. you know, just tasting a strawberry. If a person has not tasted a strawberry, how do you explain that? So there are no words that accurately describe. And, you know, we just do the best we can. And, you know, this has been fun, you know, to try to put words to something that, you know, was it and is so profound.
Yeah, I know we got to wrap up here in the next minute or so, but you know, this is an odd question because you said there's no words. And I want to get personal. You're really good at explaining things for other people to understand, but if you would be willing to be vulnerable, what is like a mantra or a saying or remembrance for yourself? You told us the one for your relationship, you belong to me and you're free. What is like the takeaway for you that you're like, Robert, you know, internal dialogue, remember this? Can you distill it down? Is it one thing?
Well, you know, the what I shared earlier, I've continued this practice throughout the day of breathing. Is Bobby breathe, Bobby breathe, because one of the experiences I had with the medicine was at my birth, being born with my lungs full of my own excrement. So, you know, there's the shitting again and the shame and not being able to breathe. And, you know, the breathe. We have to breathe. So it's been breathing, opening, and going towards what's difficult. It has been my real core mantra. The other one that I mentioned is letting my light shine, just shining. Mm-hmm. So don't put a bushel over it. Don't hide it. Don't hold back. And so that means if something scares me, that's what I have to go towards. That's what I have to lean into. And I've been doing that in one way or another, probably since I turned 40. Those have been kind of the core pieces. If it scares me, bring it out in the open. Cause like they say, what's coming is going, and you know, whatever is coming up, if we'll accept it, go into it, relax into it, it will leave. And, and that's been really powerful.
This has been beautiful to hear and unpack. And even though it's indescribable, we're trying to give people a picture on what happened, you know, so people can watch this when they ask you, hey, what happened? You just watch this. And I just love it. the theme for me again is just openness and acceptance. So it's the acceptance of what is, whether you go through an experience like this as an individual, as a couple, acceptance of what is, and that's powerful, because then you can walk into the world with it without the shame and just be why you were put here in the first place, right? Like, yeah. Opens you up to that.
Yeah. And, you know, probably we'll spend the rest of our lives, you know, opening and accepting and letting go of shame. But yeah, it's just been a beautiful container and process to do that at a really accelerated rate. And I'm grateful for my wife. I'm grateful she was there. I'm grateful she took the risk of telling me a lot of things that she was sure I would leave her if she told me. That really was part of what's cracked us open so much, is her willing to take that risk. And I've always told her, you're my model. You know, she's the most courageous person I know. She inspires me to be courageous. And again, you know, who saw that coming? You know, only either one of us had any thought, this is where we'll end up after the ceremony.
Well, I just want to say I'm grateful for you for being vulnerable and wanting to share this story and unpack it. And yeah, I just want to tell you that if we ever do destroy this planet, that I will willingly follow you to the next planet for the next 10,000 years. So.
Yeah,
I love you, brother.
You know, let's save the one we're on. Austin, thank you so much. Thank you for the invitation to do this. It has been so much fun. And if by us putting this out in the world, it you know, helps some other people on their journey as well, it's fantastic. I'm grateful for that.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for the time.
You bet. Austin, thank you.